The Raft by Robert Trumbull. Copyright 1942 by Henry Holton Company. This unabridged recording of the reading of The Raft was published by arrangement with Henry Holton Company, Incorporated, and was produced in 1996 by Blackstone Audiobooks, Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Audiobooks. This book is read by Tom Parker. This book is 213 pages long. The following material appears on the book's back cover. This story of three men adrift in the Pacific, with few resources except courage and indomitable human spirit, is not only inspiring reading, but a tribute to the human species and its will to survive. Captain John M. Waters, United States Coast Guard, retired, author of Rescue at Sea. The Raft by Robert Trumbull. Foreword by John M. Waters, Captain, United States Coast Guard, retired. To truly appreciate the epic tale of survival told in The Raft, one must first look at the setting in which it occurred, which the original edition, published in 1942, could not reveal because of wartime secrecy rules. Following the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor on December 7, 1941, America and its allies were thrown on the defensive around the world. Japanese forces streamed into the Philippines, Malaya, Indonesia, and the islands of the Central and Southwest Pacific in a series of uninterrupted victories, while in the Atlantic, rampaging U-boats threatened to close down the east coast ports of the United States. With much of its battleship strength smashed at Pearl Harbor, and little likelihood of British help following the sinking of the Prince of Wales and Repulse in the Gulf of Siam, the Pacific Fleet had only three carriers, the Enterprise, Saratoga, and Lexington, and their supporting cruisers and destroyers to protect Hawaii from the mighty Japanese combined fleet. Before Christmas, the Pacific Fleet aborted an attempt to reinforce the hard-pressed garrison at Wake Island because the top command realized that waiting Japanese forces could be in a position to inflict crippling losses on the carriers. To the men of the fleet, desperate to help their brothers on Wake, the strategic picture was not so clear, and morale dropped amid bitter grumbling when the relief attempt was canceled. Safeguarding the sea lines of communication to Australia through the Allied islands of Samoa and New Caledonia was the first priority. In early January, a fast troop convoy carrying the 2nd Marine Brigade sailed from San Diego to reinforce the defenses of Samoa. The convoy's escort was the newly formed Task Force 17, with Rear Admiral Frank Jack Fletcher flying his flag in the Yorktown, freshly arrived from the Atlantic Fleet. At the same time, Admiral Ernest J. King, Commander-in-Chief U.S. Fleet, urged the new Commander-in-Chief Pacific Fleet, Admiral Chester W. Nimitz, to take some aggressive action for effect on general morale, a move Nimitz was already planning. On January 8, 1942, Nimitz ordered Vice Admiral William F. Bull Halsey in the Enterprise to sortie with Task Force 8, one carrier, three cruisers, and seven destroyers, join with Fletcher's Task Force 17, and after delivery of the troop convoy to Samoa, strike Japanese installations in the Marshalls and Gilberts at the beginning of February. It was to be the first counterattack of the war. Embarked on the Enterprise was Carrier Air Group 6, and its torpedo bomber squadron was VT-6, Torpedo 6, which listed among its members Harold F. Dixon, Anthony J. Pastula, and Gene D. Aldrich, three men, only casually acquainted, who were soon to face a terrifying ordeal of forced togetherness. Task Force 8 crossed the equator near Howland Island, where Amelia Earhart had disappeared less than 5 years before, but the ships observed none of the traditional line-crossing ceremonies because of the serious war situation and the men's general disgruntlement. On January 16, 1942, aircraft from the Enterprise continued their aggressive patrolling for Japanese submarines believed in the area. The carrier Saratoga had been torpedoed northwest of Oahu the previous week and had limped back to Pearl Harbor, screened by the rest of Task Force 14. The Lexington and Task Force 11, badly in need of replenishment, followed the Saratoga into Pearl. With Task Force 17 guarding the vital troop convoy, Halsey's Enterprise was for the moment the Navy's only carrier available for immediate use, and nothing short of an all-out disaster would interfere with her mission, as Dixon, Pastula, and Aldrich would soon discover. That morning, one of the Enterprise's torpedo bombers crashed on landing, mortally wounding a chief petty officer operating the arresting gear. Later, two sailors died in accidents on other ships of the force. By the time Dixon, Pastula, and Aldrich manned TBD Devastator Aircraft 6T6, a low-wing single-engine torpedo bomber made by Douglas, for the afternoon anti-submarine patrol, it had not been a good day. All three of the crew members were petty officers, Dixon being a chief aviation machinist's mate. He was also a designated Naval Aviation Pilot, or NAP. Officer pilots were designated Naval Aviators, or NAs, though both groups had the same aviation training and wore identical gold wings. The Navy had started training enlisted men as pilots in the First World War and continued doing so, except for the years 1931 to 35, when none were trained because of lack of funds. In 1926, Congress dictated that the number of enlisted pilots could not exceed 30% of the number of officer pilots, and the following year, Fighting Squadron VF-2 was set up to test the feasibility of mixed NA-NAP manning. At the outbreak of war, VF-2 had 6 NAs and 16 NAPs, and a record of performance and readiness unsurpassed in the fleet. The NAPs ranked from chief down to second class. Service-wide, 13% of all pilots in the Navy, Coast Guard, and Marine Corps were enlisted, and the practice was common in other nations and services, though not in the Army Air Corps. The enlisted pilots quickly established a fine combat record, and most were later commissioned. The NAP designator was abolished in the post-war sea services, though the last of the enlisted pilots did not retire until the 1970s. Chief Dixon, at 41, a seasoned Navy veteran with 22 years of service, was considerably older than his two crewmen. Pastula, a 24-year-old aviation ordnance man second class, was the bomber in the mid-cockpit seat. Aldrich, 22, an aviation radio man third class, was the radio man and rear seat gunner. The three had never flown together as a team and were only casually acquainted. Dixon recounts the story of their last flight and subsequent adventures in the pages that follow, but he leaves the reader with some troubling questions. First, how did they become lost on this relatively short flight? Anyone who has ever flown over water has at some time been lost, but most resolve their dilemma and fly home. Aerial navigation by tactical aircraft was rather primitive at the time, mostly dead reckoning, calculating position by the courses steered, indicated airspeed, and time on each leg. Pilots had to make allowances and corrections for sometimes unreliable magnetic compasses, but changing winds were the biggest sources of error. To calculate the wind, a pilot used an E6B navigation plotter, entering wind drift readings taken on various headings with a drift indicator instrument, or simply eyeballed the surface and estimated the wind. Both methods could be either highly accurate or badly in error, depending on the expertise of the observer. On most flights, proper pre-flight planning and execution brought the plane back within sight of the carrier, or near enough, 40 miles, to pick up the ship's YE radio beacon transmitter and home in with the aircraft's ZB receiver. The YE beacon was a short-range, highly directional radio that transmitted a different alphabet letter in Morse code for each 15-degree sector. The pilot had merely to listen, identify the sector in which he was flying, and fly inbound on the mid-sector heading to reach the carrier. The ship changed the sector alignments daily to prevent enemy aircraft from homing in on the signal. Early in the war, the Enterprise had the CXAM radar, a primitive type installed in 1941. It had a maximum range of perhaps 80 miles on large, high-flying formations, and as little as 20 to 30 miles on single aircraft. Because few of the aircraft were then equipped with IFF, Identification Friend or Foe, transponders, there was some confusion as to an individual aircraft's identity in a crowded sky. A troubled pilot could not expect the instant radar steers that became commonplace later in the war with the advent of better equipment, and of course any radar help required ship-to-plane radio contact. Attack aircraft at the time carried a short-range voice radio, or VHF, good for perhaps 50 miles at 5,000 feet, and a medium-frequency, or MF, Morse code set, operated by the rear-seat radio man that was capable of long-range communications.